Good morning, everyone. Okay. It is now 10:35, and I'd like to start the call meeting to order. I know that's quite a short transition. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Access Committee meeting of November 18. Let's start with roll call.
Chair Perkins?
Here.
Vice Chair Arriscada? Vice Chair Arriscada?
Here.
Regent McMichael?
Here.
Regent Moran? Regent Tarkanian? You have a quorum.
Thank you. And that moves us down to public comment. Is there any public comment in Elko? I'll take that as a no. Any public comment in Reno?
No, there's not.
Thank you. Any public comment in Las Vegas? Seeing none, and is there any virtual public comments? Great, thank you. With that, I'll move on to the minutes for possible action. The committee will consider approval of the minutes from the September 9th meeting. Do I hear a motion? Thank you.
Motion for approval.
Okay, I'll take Regent Moran as the first, or the motion maker, and the second from Regent, or Vice Chair Arriscada. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
I vote aye as well. Any opposed? Any abstentions? Awesome. Moving on to number three, Chair's Report. I'll try to be brief. So first of all, I'd like to thank everyone who put this meeting together. Due to some a family emergency in my family, and I really appreciate how hard staff had to work and the grace that was given me by the Inchi family. So I just wanted to put that out there. Thank you very much. The other comment, you know, usually I like to get straight down to business, but today I feel it very important to have a few minutes of reflections and thoughts about this committee. I've tried to create a culture of open door, open communication, and general camaraderie, whereas the opinions of all and those thoughts are accepted in a safe environment. And so I hope I've conveyed that and lived that and stanchioned that to everyone in this room and those listening virtually. In the future, to continue that camaraderie and that communication, I would greatly appreciate agenda items coming through the chair or the vice chair to make sure that we are engaged and involved and you have our opinion as well as other opinions from the board, and since that is one of our major charges. And with that, I will move on to number four, the handbook revisions about the anti-bias and anti-discrimination chain. Mr. Martinez.
Thank you, Chair. For the record, Jimmy Martinez, Chief General Counsel. And I apologize, Chief of Staff Crystal Ava was not able to make it today, so I will do my best to present the item and answer any questions the committee may have. This item originated, the origination goes back to September of 2022, when the Board of Regents approved the anti-discrimination resolution. That resolution was condemning discriminatory incidents and actions. The resolution also encouraged anti-racist and anti-bias training for board members and members of the NG community. This item is a proposal to revise Title IV, Chapter 8, and these revisions would require each NG institution, unit, and board office to establish and conduct diversity education and training. And these trainings may be included in existing training efforts. This revision would also mandate annual reporting on the status of and outcomes of those training programs. And that would be specifically to evaluate the impact of the training. The effective date of the training would be December 31st, 2023. That would give the institutions, units, and board office approximately 1 year to develop and implement these training modules. And on October 26th of this year, the IDEA Council did have the opportunity to review and endorse this proposal. And with that, I will be available for any questions.
Thank you. Any questions from anyone on the committee?
Question, Madam Chair?
I'm sure. Go ahead, Vice Chair Arizcata.
As I pull up the new anti-discrimination, bear with me here, the training and some of the additions and or policy proposals. On number one of the proposal of each institution and the Chancellor's Office, Mr. Martinez, if you know what I'm referring to.
I do.
The strong statement that's here on the statements of effects of bias and discrimination, including racism, anti-Semitism, age, disability, gender, military status or obligations, sexual orientations, gender identity, gender identity or expression, national origin, race, color, and religion. That's a strong group, and I commend all of them. However, on anti-Semitism, there is an asterisk or a number one identifying a reference, and the reference is to the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. Could you expand a little bit more on this, if why this particular religion was identified more and holds more gravity than others?
Yes, for the record, Jimmy Martinez, System General Counsel. I wouldn't say that it was added because it holds, it has any more gravity than the others. I think, and this is kind of a national trend, and I am by no means an expert in this specific area, but what I have learned is it's been nationally recognized that there is concern across the nation that anti-Semitism takes place in various different ways, and it's not just necessarily a religion. It's not just necessarily a national origin. There was recently a press release from the department, the State Department of the federal government, talking about this. So this group, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, developed in 2016 this definition of anti-Semitism, and it also gave examples. This was referenced in an executive order at one point. The Office of Civil Rights has begun using this definition and its examples in its investigations to look towards motive. I mean, it's a very complex area, but we did think it was very important to include this because of the need that we've seen across the nation to include this specifically in here as a mode of training.
Thank you, and I agree wholeheartedly with everything you just said. Are there other religions that have been identified or other individuals who seek a different religious preference who also have had crimes against them because of their appearance that need to be placed on this anti-discrimination proposal also?
What we've tried to do is, you know, make these items as broad as possible to encompass all religions, national origins. I think currently anti-Semitism would be covered under those general statements, but it has been brought to our attention that there's a separate need and a different understanding that, you know, there's a lack of understanding in our country and across college campuses specifically with relation to this. Of course, if any other protected class were to make us aware of some other type of training that needed to be done, I don't think anybody would object to that education. We just haven't been made aware of any others. But I do think this language is broad enough to encompass any of those.
Excellent. Answered the question perfectly. And one of the items in which you were very specific on is the training. We do want to focus on the training and full inclusivity of all, regardless the religion a person truly follows. There's 12 major religions in this world. Did a little bit of research here. Baha'i, Buddhism, Christianity, Confucianism, Hinduism, Islam, Jainism, Judaism, Shinto, Sikhism, Taoism, and the world's oldest is Zoroastrianism. With all of these 12, we want to make sure that there is going to be an open mind that can consciously focus on all religion aspects, regardless of which denomination you follow. And I actually commend the entire committee for focusing on all aspects of diversity. So very well done, and I fully support this addition and revision to the handbook.
Thank you. Any further questions from anybody on the committee? Regent Carter?
I'm not on the committee. Is that still okay?
Yes.
Okay. So on number two, all employees and members of the Board of Regents must receive the training required pursuant to subsection 1, etc. So for employees, I guess there's a punitive element, you know, to that if they don't do the training. I'm assuming you could clarify that. But for the Board of Regents, what would be the... I mean, can you really force a board member to do anything?
Jimmy Martinez, for the record. As elected officials, it's not like, and she has the power to punitively end your term. So there is a much different level of authority over employees than regents. So that is an accurate statement. Of course, we would hope that all regents have the individual interest to go through the training and continue to learn and continue to follow the NSHE directives that this board votes on.
Did that answer your questions? Any further questions from from anyone, actually, in or outside the committee?
Wow. Madam Chair?
I can't tell.
Sorry.
I can't tell who that is. I can't see you guys. Oh, okay.
Madam Chair, for the record, Dale Urquiaga, Acting Chancellor.
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a question. I just would like to make a comment before you move on this policy. As you stated, I want to recognize the work that went into this from the staff and the regents who brought these issues to our attention and to the IDEA Council. One of the things I've heard since I've been here is we can talk about things, and there is a difference when we actually act. And so I commend you for pushing us, and I commend other regents who have pushed us to act more quickly in this space. Sometimes we can't get out of our own way. So I want that on the record that the regents worked very hard to make sure this happened, and the staff, I think, responded well, including the IDEA Council. So I think not only is this the right thing to do, it's probably overdue, but I really appreciate the robust conversation and the board asking that you be included in this training as well. So it's just my thanks to all of you.
Thank you for that comment. Regent Brooks.
Thank you, Chair. Now, I'm not part of this subcommittee, and I appreciate that you would give me an opportunity to voice my opinion. I couldn't be more thankful that this is before us and that the amount of work that you and everyone has done. I was very vocal when we were at I think we were at Nevada State College when a resolution came before us that I felt didn't have any meat on the bone. And this has plenty of meat on the bone for the entire state of Nevada. And so I am very supportive of this and just want to thank you and everybody who was involved in putting this together. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for that comment. Okay. This is an action item. And if there's, I see some diversity officers in our audience. Do any of the diversity officers have comments? I hear crickets.
Chair Perkins.
So thank you. Oh, okay. And please state your name and spell your last name for the record.
I'm Seval Yildirim, last name spelled Y-I-L-D-I-R-I-M. I'm the Vice President for Diversity Initiatives and the Chief Diversity Officer at UNLV. I applaud everyone in this room. I'm pretty new to Nevada and to my position, so I applaud everyone in this room to have actually put this together, and I really appreciate the comments made so far. As a civil rights attorney, having litigated cases on behalf of religious minorities, I also applaud the addition of anti-Semitism. I'm only going to add one comment, that Islamophobia also be included in the language. Thank you so much.
Thank you for that comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Honorable Regents. Lawrence Weekly, College of Southern Nevada, Chief Diversity Officer. I guess one question that we would have is, as far as the training is concerned, because we too appreciate all the work that have gone into moving this matter forward. At our Ideal Council, we've had a lot of discussion on this, and, you know, you've done a lot of heavy lifting in making sure that this item does move forward. And so as it relates to training, do we have an idea who will conduct that training? And, you know, is that a discussion we believe, Ms. Martinez, that will maybe come back to the Ideal Council that we can maybe offer some support and recommendations as well?
Thank you. I can answer that. I think the training is going to be left up to each individual institution, but Mr. Martinez can expound on that.
Jimmy Martinez, for the record, that's correct. And that's the reason why this has been, the effective date is out approximately 1 year till December of 23, to leave every institution, unit, and the board office all ample time to not only develop, but also implement these training modules. It also can be, per the language of the code revision or the handbook revision, it can be included in current training modules. So the larger institutions that already have robust training modules, this will be an addition. So because each of our institutions is so different in how it handles this type of training, we thought it was very important to allow that autonomy so each can handle it as appropriate for their institution.
Thank you so much for that answer. Regent Carvalho.
Thank you, Chair Perkins. I appreciate the opportunity to speak. I'm not on this committee, but I support this this code revision wholeheartedly. I would ask or encourage for the training for regents to be done by our institutions. I think we have experts who are part of our grade eight, and I think it would be wonderful if they provided the training for us. Thank you.
Thank you for that suggestion. So I'll take that and then put it in new
business. Madam Chair.
I'm sorry. I apologize, Regent. Go ahead, Regent.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I'm not on this committee either, but I have a quick question for the young lady who said she's new at UNLV. We were talking about religions being mentioned in all of this. She said something that's I'd like her to help us with. Islamophobia. What exactly do you mean by that? That is not a religion. So where is that coming from? Let's make sure we have all our I's dotted and our T's crossed. So, madam, if you could help me with that, is that a religion?
So thank you first for calling me a young lady. I appreciate that. So when we speak about anti-Semitism, we're referring to prejudices and systemic discrimination against Jewish people and how those perceptions play out on our campuses. When we speak about Islamophobia, the term comes from phobia of Muslim people, right? Islamophobia. So we have seen a similar trend against Muslims in this country in terms of prejudices against Muslims playing out in hate crimes and discriminatory conduct on our campuses, as well as in speech patterns against our students, faculty, staff, and administrators. So I would identify those two religions in particular as subjects or objects of discriminatory conduct and belief systems. And I say this having represented Jewish, Muslim, and Rastafarian plaintiffs in federal courts in this country, either as attorney of record or as a legal consultant working with grassroots organizations, and as being a law professor whose specialty is in law and religion and First Amendment's law and religion clauses.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I may go on
for
another question. Excuse me. We don't have Jewophobia or Christianophobia. So why do you bring in this thing, Islamophobia? Because it is the fear of Islam.
Right.
It is not the fear of Muslim people.
Sure.
So why do you bring that in as part of a religion? Right. It is still, Islam was mentioned.
Right.
Regent Ariscada mentioned Sikhism, Islam, everything.
Sure.
But why do you specifically want to stop people from being afraid of Islam? It does not say Muslim people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It is the fear of Islam.
Sure. It is not my choice of verbiage. It is just the verbiage that has been used in the courts and in scholarship. So we can certainly talk about anti-Muslim sentiments that would relate, I guess, linguistically speaking, that would be parallel to anti-Semitism. It is just not the lingo that has been used. I appreciate your desire for consistency and would have no problem with that language. It's, again, just not the language that has been used in scholarship and in the courts and in court decisions.
Ma'am, I think what we are doing here is trying to differentiate between a religion and a fear. We are marking all these religions, and I don't want to minimize their importance by bringing in the terms that are used, which have no meaning at all. You're saying the fear of Islam. Like I said already, we don't have fear of Judaism. We don't have fear of Christianity. We just mentioned religion. So if you muddy the waters like this by bringing in terms that are popular and the terms that are used nowadays to make everybody shut up and be silent, I think you are doing us a disservice, ma'am. I'd appreciate the work you will do in the future and everything else, but please differentiate between a religion and the fear of a religion. So we've marked all the religions that we should watch out for and protect them.
Sure,
but
I absolutely agree with you. My only point was if we are identifying groups who are particularly targeted on our campuses, and anti-Semitism has been identified as a point of necessity for training. And my only point is the other group, because it was asked by Regent Ariscada, is there any other religious group that has been similarly targeted on campuses? And my answer would be, statistically speaking, that would be yes. The other religious group that has been similarly targeted on college campuses has been Muslims. So I appreciate your desire for consistency in language, but again, I stand by my request that we include Muslims as well as a group that have been targeted on our college campuses. Thank you.
Thank you for that answer.
Did that
answer everything, Regent Boylan?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much for your patience and the lady's explanation. Thank you, ma'am.
Can that language be added?
for the record, Jimmy Martinez, this is not an area where I am an expert. So from that conversation, I must admit I did get a little confused because I believe the first recommendation was to include xenophobia. The second recommendation was to include the Muslim religion. Religion, all religions are protected under the current language under the and for the training. So I at this point I don't think I would be comfortable offering revised language because it's not something that I have researched or am an expert in.
Okay. So, but we can give instruction to add Islamophobia somewhere in the specific list because, like was brought out that other groups that have been targeted on campus specifically, and since that is another group that's specifically targeted, then in inclusivity, then we should try to accommodate those.
Absolutely. Jimmy Martinez, for the record, this group has resources who know a lot more about this than I do. So I would recommend the committee take recommendations and make its own determination. And I will revise language as you see fit.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Vice Chair Carvalho.
Thank you, Chair Perkins. I am worried that this is going to come across as wordsmithing, and I certainly don't want to get in the weeds on that. But hearing the discussion here today, I do wonder if it would be appropriate to not include anti-Semitism, but include the word all and an S at the end of religions so that we are sure that all religions are included. That may be wordsmithing, and I don't mean to do that necessarily. And I'm not diminishing any religion at all. I just wonder if that would be more inclusive of a direction. But that's just my interpretation of this. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that because I can see this beginning. Like you said, we can't mention the 12, 13 major religions. So all religions seem to take care of it all. If that's is that an easy on the fly?
Jimmy Martinez, for the record, I think we need to be a little bit careful of what we're asking for. Please remember that this is mandatory training. So if there's a mandate that the training address every religion on the planet, I don't know if that would be a feasible training. So the protections, of course, are for all, protect all religions. Those exist in a separate policy. This is a new code or handbook revision mandating training on this area. That's why we try to use broad statements like religion that you can manage that training aspect to apply to all religions without this becoming a course in religious studies that everybody has to go through.
I see your point with that. This is a difficult one. I don't have another option with that, but thank you for that explanation.
Yeah. That's a difficult one. I really want to see the Islamophobia in there also. But then the document could become, like you said, impossible. It could be a class in world religions. And I don't want to see that either.
Madam
I don't
Chair.
Want to put that burden. I couldn't hear. Who's that?
Madam Chair, Acting Chancellor Urquiaga.
Okay, go ahead. Thank you, Dale. Step in.
Sorry, Madam Chair. This is not my area of expertise, but I have been reading, as this policy has been evolving, the research behind some of these terms. And so I'm going to try an explanation at The way I speak, I do not speak like many of you from higher education. Anti-Semitism is not just about the Jewish religion. It is about a people. Islamophobia is not just about the religion. If you look up the definition, it is about Islam as a political force as well as a religion. And so I think it is entirely appropriate to include both terms, because both terms are singled out in today's society for discrimination in ways different from other religions, which are covered by this policy. So my recommendation to you would be both words have broader meaning than the other word religion, and both words are acceptable in this policy.
Well, that settles
Madam
that.
Chair.
Thank you. Regent Boylan.
Thank you, ma'am. I appreciate your patience with me not being on the committee, everything else. Chancellor Quiroga just said anti-Semitism. He's talking about the Semites and, you know, just sort of bad things against them. When you're talking about anti-Islamophobia, that is not a religion, and I will stress that till the last day. That is just the thought and the fear of Islam. Are we going to control what people think now, not just what they say? Anti-Semitism, now if they include anti-Islam, that's fine. But anti-Islamophobia, now that doesn't make any sense. We are higher education. Please study this, ask the people who know about this. And if you say anti-Semite, say, okay, anti-Islam, that's fine with me. But to say anti-Islamophobia, that's stupid. We're just using and being used for a political or a religious term that people want to use to say this is against the Islamic people. It is not. It is a thought process. It is a fear. But anti-Semite or anti-Semitic, now that's totally different too. It's not Semite phobia. We're not saying
Excuse
that.
Me, Regent Boylan. Is there?
Yes, ma'am.
Is there
a point to what I'm saying?
Yes, thank you, sir.
Yes, that is the point. The thought of phobia is the thought of fear. It is a fear in the mind. Are we going to control that? Say anti-Islam, that's fine. Anti-Semite, that's fine. Anti-Sikh or anything else, but to say anti what people think. Please, let's not be used by certain groups. And no, this is something we in higher education need to understand and ask some further experts. And if you need me to discuss this with anybody, I will be ready to, ma'am. And I know this is not the time, but we want to get the words right.
Yes, we do. Absolutely want to get this right.
Thank you,
and
ma'am.
These are our experts.
Thank
these
you, ma'am.
Are people that this is their livelihood. This is their expertise. And the IDEA Council, that's their work. So I value the opinions, and the wording from this was vetted by the council. So and I think Islamophobia was overlooked or not included, but it can be included now, and we are taking the advice of our experts that are in our grade 8. And with
so
oh,
are we just
Regent
taking,
Carter.
Sorry, ma'am. Sorry.
So once again, I'm not on the committee, but in listening to our counsel, it sounds like possibly, if we removed anti-Semitism, religion is still in there. Because I'm thinking, like, you know, when COVID came out and there's all this violence against Asians, so there's always going to be maybe this different group that needs to change every year or be added. And so I don't know that any particular religion needs to be in there. That's my thought.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Regent Brooks.
Regent Brooks, for the record, thank you. I greatly appreciate the robustness of this conversation. However, I would like to offer that Judaism, the Jewish people, the Jewish culture, it's not merely just a religion. There's a lot more spokes on that wheel, and I think classifying it as simply one religion it really doesn't do it justice. So I'm encouraging the committee to maintain the form in which this has come before you and then will be approved to come before the board, that anti-Semitism most certainly remain inside this as part of an education process for anyone who's affiliated with ENCHI, the board, and our institutions. So thank you.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that comment. Well, I guess now we have a decision to make. Does anybody...
Chair Perkins?
Go ahead, Regent Arascata.
I apologize, Chair. Just quick question. At the conclusion of the anti-bias and anti-discrimination training and or prior to it, if a regent oversteps its boundaries or their boundaries in regards to statements, actions, verbiage, has anything been written? And I might want to forward this over to our chancellor. Has anything been prepared in regards to something punitive, as in censorship or anything of that type?
Madam Chair, for the record, Dale Urquiaga. Regent Arascata, to my knowledge, no. And as the general counsel has alluded previously, you are elected officials, and so you are subject to state law. You would be subject to recall for your actions. But to my knowledge, there's nothing in the handbook currently that would provide a process for example, your peers on the board to censure you for failure to act or an action. I will play the new guy card. I've been here 5 months and it's a 645-page document. So for all I know, there's something in there, but I don't believe there is. So I'm not your lawyer. Mr. Martinez is. But I would say you're, as elected officials, you're subject to the provisions of state law. You might consider your own process for some other form of accountability.
And for the record, Chair, Jimmy Martinez, Title IV, Chapter 8 does set out ENCHI's anti-discrimination policy, and that is the prohibition. And in terms of censorship, I would also point out that we are always very careful to ensure that violations of any individual's First Amendment does not come into play. And that is that's a big reason why today we're talking about training. And we can talk about these things in terms of training without talking about them as prohibitions, which, if we were, could violate First Amendment rights in certain circumstances.
Did that answer your question?
Very much so. And on that, Madam Chair, I move for approval.
Okay. With including the Islamophobia or as is or...
As is.
Just couldn't give it to the chair. Sorry.
Okay. I have a motion on the floor by Regent Arascata. Do I hear a second? A second by Regent Moran. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Okay.
Then that motion carries. We have a hot mic in Elko. We have a hot mic in Elko.
Yeah, I was trying to get in with you. I just
apologize.
Wanted to. It's okay. I won't. It'll be fine. I'm good.
Okay. That with that the motion passes. We now have a training policy. Okay, moving on to ENCHI Equity in Hiring and Retention, Blind Hire for Information Only. Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For this particular agenda item, as we've been working with the Idea Council and Acting Chancellor, Mr. Dale Urquiaga, one of the things that have came up and have been priorities of both the council and Mr. Urquiaga is the idea of equity in retention and in hiring and retention. Previous Chancellor Rose actually had a task force that looked at this particular issue, and they were doing some work along the lines of, you know, looking at ways that NSHE as a system could put into place affirmative, active processes to ensure that we could diversify our staff and faculty. And one of the ways that, you know, we've been talking about and researching is through this concept and idea of blind hiring. So what today is just an informational presentation from Ms. Amber Clayton, Senior Director, Knowledge Center Operations for the Society for Human Resource Management, or better known as SHRM. And what she will do is she will present background information and related research on the blind hiring process. And what blind hiring is a recruitment strategy that promotes diverse hiring by blocking out information such as a job candidate's personal information, and usually by way of doing this on job applications and supportive materials such as resumes that could influence or bias a hiring decision. Typically what you see is when people are trying to get into the door of a job, the number one step is being able to get your resume reviewed and getting past that minimum qualifications step. And so what this particular presentation will do, it kind of ties into NSHE's strategic planning efforts by examining a process that targets equity in hiring and retention throughout the system, which is also a priority of Acting Chancellor Urquiaga and the NSHE's IDEA Council. So with that, I will hand it over to Ms. Amber Clayton, who will be joining us virtually.
Thank you. Again, my name is Amber Clayton. I'm the Senior Director of Knowledge Center Operations with the Society for Human Resource Management. Thank you for allowing me to be here today to speak on talent acquisition and blind hiring. First, let me tell you a little bit about SHRM, what we do, and who we are. We are a professional membership organization of over 300,000 HR professionals, or individuals who are accountable for HR. We work with CEOs as well as legal counsel and other positions around the world. Our purpose is to elevate HR, and this is our North Star. It is everything that we drive, everything that we want to do. Our vision is the future of HR, building a work that works for all. To achieve this, SHRM is committed to empowering people and workplaces by advancing HR practices and maximizing human potential. And in doing so, we're working together to elevate your impact and leadership in the workplace and improve the lives of people that you serve. First, I want to share a little bit of research. We do quite a bit of research on the workplace, and part of our research happened to be in the diversity, equity, and inclusion area. We conducted a survey last year where respondents were categorized as, quote, leaders, those who rated the organizations as very successful at improving DE&I, followers, those who rated their organizations as moderately successful, and laggards, those who rated the organizations as unsuccessful at improving DE&I. What we found is that 65% of respondents say that DE&I is a high strategic priority. 50% of respondents from DEI laggard companies say a lack of leadership commitment hinders their diversity, equity, inclusion efforts. And only 5% of DEI leader companies say that they have this issue. We also found that the most common area in which organizations track diversity is in their hiring. 74% of all respondents track the diversity of new hires. Recruiting is next at 64%, followed by retention at 47%. And all other aspects of diversity are tracked by less than 40% of respondents. Part of success of an organization is having diverse employees, which match the diversity of their communities and customers, or in this case, your students. So in sheet demographics, I just want to take a look at some of the demographics from the data that I found on your website. And I inserted these just so that you have a visual of how employee and student populations compare. As you can see, in the fall of 2020, 44.7% were male employees compared to 41% of male students. 55.3% were female employees compared to 58.1% female students. That's pretty close. Now, if you look at the next slide, which is the demographics, your comparison based on ethnicity and race, and I know it's hard to see the numbers here, but in looking at the columns, you'll notice some significant differences. You can see from the charts that your non-white employee population is higher than all other ethnicities and races. Your Hispanic employee headcount is lower than your Hispanic student populations. I'm not implying that this is good or bad because, of course, there are multiple factors that weigh into this. This is just for your reference, and it's great information that you're collecting and that you can use this to bolster your DE&I efforts. Many employers don't actually collect this type of information unless they're required to do so by law. So let's talk about the hiring practices. And just going back on what I mentioned in the previous slide, that 65% of respondents say that diversity, equity, and inclusion is a high strategic priority. And the most common area in which the organizations track diversity is in their hiring. We know that employers are significantly different when it comes to how they post their jobs, interview, hire candidates, and often during these processes, our unconscious bias impacts our decisions. So if we look at hiring bias, according to Deloitte's 2019 State of Inclusion Survey, 64% of the workers surveyed felt that they had experienced bias in their workplaces during the last year, and of those, 61% felt experienced bias in the workplace at least once a month. And some of you may already know this information, so I apologize if I'm going over something that you already are aware of, but you know, what does hiring bias mean? You've probably heard the term unconscious bias or hidden bias or implicit bias. And, you know, believe it or not, we all have some type of unconscious bias, which affect the way that we live and we work. And it doesn't mean that we're bad, we're humans. And it occurs when individuals make judgments about people based on certain characteristics without even realizing that they're doing it. There are several different types of biases, like, for example, weight bias, judging someone negatively because of their weight. And my sister actually was morbidly obese when I was growing up, and I can recall her having difficulty finding employment and couldn't help but wonder if it was because of her weight. Had she been thinner, would that have made a difference? There's also affinity bias, which is gravitating towards people like you. I think we've all hired someone who has traits like ours. I'm a good worker, and the person reminds me of myself. I have somebody right now that reminds me of me when I was younger. So you have to ask yourself, do you hire employees who have similar traits as you or people who are like you? There's also name bias, where you judge someone based on their name or you make assumptions. For instance, you have an applicant with the last name of Aludalapo, and you might decide to pick Mr. Jones over Mr. Aludalapo because you think that Mr. Aludalapo might have an accent, that he might not be able to be understood clearly. And identifying these biases and how they negatively impact workers in the workplace, it's important when you're developing your diversity, equity, inclusion efforts. So that brings us to the topic of blind hiring. What is it? There are many different ways an employer can reduce bias. And today I'm just going to talk about blind hiring. Blind hiring essentially is removing the personal information from the candidate's resume or the application, like their name, their address, age, educational institutions, personal interests, and photos. And believe it or not, there are resumes that come with photos. So blind hiring, let's talk about where it began. It's actually from the 1970s. There was a Toronto orchestra that was predominantly white men, and they wanted to have a more diverse orchestra. So they had musicians audition behind curtains so that the only thing they could hear was their skills on the instruments. And in doing so, they hired up to 45% more females and other more diverse instrumentalists. I think about this today and with shows like The Masked Singer and The other one, I'm going to draw a blank on it, but I believe it's The Voice. I don't actually watch that one, sorry. But the judges have to turn around and they have to listen to the music, or in the Masked Singer, they actually have, you know, mask on, costumes on, and you're judging them based on their talent. So by hiding the personal information that might unconsciously impact your hiring decisions, it allows you to focus on the candidate's skills, knowledge, and the abilities. Oh, sorry. Go to the next slide, please. Thank you. So you may be asking yourself, why would you want to remove someone's name or educational institution from the resume? Well, personal information can reveal a lot about an individual's race, their ethnicity, their religion, their sex, financial status, and other classes. And that, you know, those may be protected under federal or state laws. And so names, for example, can reveal race and gender. And studies have shown that, quote, black-sounding names result in fewer callbacks than white-sounding names. There was a study done by the National Bureau of Economic Research that indicated that white-sounding names such as Emily Walsh and Greg Baker got 50% more callbacks than black-sounding names like Lakeisha Washington or Jamal Jones. Furthermore, resumes with male names are 40% more likely to get an interview than similar resumes with the same qualifications but with female names. With the address, it could actually reveal someone's income level or race, depending on where they live. For dates, milestones, it could, things like your education, that may indicate your approximate age. Hobbies could reveal things like your familial status, your religion, and names of colleges could actually be linked to race, or someone, you know, could potentially avoid hiring someone if they're not from an Ivy League school, for example. So blind hiring does have its pros and cons, and I'm going to start with the cons first. And the cons are, this doesn't completely remove the bias in the hiring process. At some point, your hiring manager will see the individual's name, they're going to see their personal information or hear about it during the interview process. So training the managers on good hiring processes and on biases may actually help reduce it. Another con is that you still may unintentionally discriminate. So if you're rejecting individuals based on gaps of employment, you could potentially be discriminating against someone, let's say a woman who's been a stay-at-home mom for several years. Many quit work during the pandemic just to care for their children and their families. And with another one, it could be difficult to pinpoint the culture fit. For instance, you know, let's say that you're a nonprofit organization and you want to hire someone, or you like to hire someone who's volunteered at other nonprofits. And so removing the personal interest or the clubs, that could exclude those candidates. The pros, though, is that you can have equal opportunities since everyone will be assessed based on their skills, their knowledge, and their abilities. It could bring in more diverse candidates for you. You can create a larger candidate pool. There's a greater awareness of bias. And the diversity could bring more innovation, better employee engagement, as well as benefit the company's bottom line. So how is it implemented? Blind hiring can be done in a couple of ways. It could be done manually or it could be done electronically. A manual process, which might work well for small organizations with very few resumes or applications, essentially includes a neutral party that would actually be taking out the personal information of a candidate before they give that resume or application to the hiring manager or to the interviewing manager. A more efficient way, of course, would be through technology. And the good news is that a program that you're currently working with right now, Workday, it does have some capabilities with regards to filtering out some of the personal information of your candidates' resumes or applications. And of course, you'd need to speak with Workday to see, you know, what you could do with your particular organization and the programs that you have, but it does appear that they can be filtered. And if not, there could be some software that could be integrated into the program in order to help you have this blind hiring process. So blind hiring, as I mentioned, that's just one piece of the puzzle when it comes to diverse, equitable, and inclusive workforces. Of course, you want to look at things like your job postings and make sure that they don't include language that might exclude people in the hiring process. You want to train your managers on hidden bias in your new recruitment process. Of course, some businesses conduct pre-employment assessments if you believe that it'll help identify the skills needed for your particular jobs. But you want to try to use blind hiring to help in this process to bring in the more diverse candidates and increase your candidate pool. And if you're uncertain about this type of approach, you could potentially pilot a program like this and see if it makes a difference within your workforce. There are many resources out there with regards to blind hiring and other DE&I initiatives. And of course, I'm available to answer any questions that you have, and I'm sure your institutes have a lot of information on this as well. But I think blind hiring can be a very positive choice for employers when they're trying to improve their DE&I efforts. Thank you. Any questions for me?
Thank you so much for that that presentation. I think it was very enlightening and a lot of information you covered very quickly. So if there's any questions from any on or off the committee, go ahead, Regent Carter.
So this may be for council or our guest. I can't remember. Ms. Clayton. There.
Amber. Yes, thank you.
So for us, so if we're doing a presidential search or something like that, how does the open meeting law or access to that information, like, so if we had, you know, candidates apply from a search firm and we wanted to eliminate the step where they weed it down or the chancellor weeds it down, and we chose to go the blind method, what are the issues that I guess that would arise in that method of doing it? Does that make sense? Sort of, kind of?
I think that's going to have to be a question that's answered by your committee. With regards to the presidents, I'm not sure exactly how your process works there. Now, I can tell you in a general way that when you're working with third parties who are, whether they're job hunters, if it's an organization, they can actually provide the information without the personal information attached to it as well. So you're just reviewing the individual's qualifications for the position. But of course, when that person is selected to be interviewed, that information is going to come out.
Mr. Martinez, would you have anything to add to that?
Jimmy Martinez, for the record, this is not something that we've analyzed at this point. It would take some analysis because we do have an entire policy, as you know, on presidential searches. Combining that with the open meeting law, I'm sure there's a way to piece the puzzle together to make it work. I just don't know exactly what that would look like at this time.
Would you like to add to that?
Sure. Rosalie Bordalove with the Attorney General's Office for the record. We have dealt with a number of times hiring by public bodies and its interplay with the open meeting law. So I can't speak to your specific policies because it kind of need to go in with your hiring policies. But a method that some of our public bodies have used when they are the hiring authority is that anonymizing applications when it's going through a search committee in those first steps, because then you can avoid some of that public nature. Now, obviously, as far as the open meeting law is concerned, any documents that are given to that body are public. So usually we've had staff anonymize them prior to dissemination to the public body in any way. So they have no idea who the people are or anything. A lot of that's anonymized. However, when you do get, and as your guest said, as you get later in the process where you're reaching interviews, the open meeting law requires names to be on your agenda. They require, in the employment sense, a lot notice to the people. There's an exception in employment, but you do need to put, if you're going to interview somebody at a meeting, their name has to be on the agenda. At that point, it's pretty public.
Did that answer you?
Can I just ask a clarifying question? Because I think I understood, but I'm going to re-say it and see if that's correct. So if we had a search and we wanted the search committee to, instead of having an individual sort through them, we wanted the committee to do it, they could be made anonymous. They would be given to the committee. That anonymous application or whatever would still have to be publicly listed. But then the committee in an open meeting could look at those anonymous resumes, if you will. So that adds a step where the whole committee can actually review applications. We wouldn't be interviewing at that point. We would just be vetting them.
Yes, essentially the committee, because any subcommittee you create is still a public body, they would still need any materials that they review and discuss are public unless you have something else making them not public, but you need some other law making them not public, which I'm guessing you don't have. But they could be anonymized by staff ahead of time. Usually as a first step, at least for a lot of the state agencies that I represent, a recommendation I give is for the committee prior to putting out the posting, meet and select criteria that they're looking for in applications. And you could still give some discretion when you delegate this authority to staff, some discretion of we're looking for this criteria, but they need to have at least 5 of the 10. And if you're going to weight them or something, right? But give direction to staff that's kind of clear objective criteria that staff can then filter your initial applications based on that. And that step, because it's staff, you're still a public entity. You have public records law to deal with, right? But the open meeting law at that point isn't triggered because the actual members of your committee haven't seen anything. And then staff brings you a list. And that's where you can have staff anonymize it if you want, and remove names and remove things so those anonymous applications are brought before you. But again, that's interplay. My awareness from the open meeting law and public records and those type. I am not an expert on ENSHE's code and hiring policies, and so I'll defer to Jimmy on those.
Was that the?
Yeah, that sounds fantastic, and it sounds like a project you can do next year when I'm gone.
Why? Thank you. I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, Regent McAdoo.
Oh, hey, Regent McAdoo, or Chair McAdoo. Oh. Go ahead, please.
No, I'm Regent in this committee. Thank you. You're the chair. I wanted to tag on to Regent Carter's question and the answers. So to me, a piece of this that we would need to look at is whether or not our consultants that we choose to hire have a blind hiring policy within their consulting firm, because to me that's where it would start, because they are the ones initially selecting the candidates to somewhat bring forth to us. So I just throw that in there as just another thought about that hiring process. Thank you.
Thank you for that comment. Any other comments from anyone on or off the committee or virtually?
Yes, Madam Chair. Go ahead,
Regent McMichael.
My question is, in the hiring, and this could also enter into the bias, how extensive is a background check other than the letters of recommendation?
Jimmy Martinez, for the record, the background check documents that we get are not overly extensive. It will show, felony convictions. It'll show things of that nature, but it's a standard background check. It's not anything that's incredibly in depth.
Tillery Williams, for the record, if I may. I've been selected during a blind hiring process. So basically, what happens is when you show up, that's the first time they're seeing you. That's the first time they're seeing your name and all of that. So you still go through the process of interviewing, because when you show up, they know who you are. So it would just be the standard background check, whether you have blind hiring or not, that would guide whether you, I think you would offer employment contingent on a black background check, which would be your standard process, regardless if you used blind hiring or not.
To follow up on that, on the background investigations, if they're just cursory in nature, how do we not find out if there's something more extensive that we should look into from the person's past experience? Because we need to know that ahead of time so that we can then make a more informed decision as to whether this individual meets certain criteria for employment. And just having a letter of recommendation, that in itself could be biased information that we receive. And without going further or deeper into a person's background, we will never know if they will make a good fit for the institution.
Is there a comment, Mr. Martinez?
Jimmy Martinez, for the record, all good points. I would defer to our presenter, who's an expert in HR processes, to determine how that should play out or what options are available and best practices.
Thank you, Chris Amber Clayton. So background checks are typically done towards the end of the interview process. They're usually not done at the beginning of the process. So this blind hiring practice does not impact the background check process that the employers have. And there are some state laws, I can't speak to yours in particular at this time, but there are some state laws that have banned the box laws, which basically are banning the questions of criminal backgrounds prior to a conditional offer of employment being made. So it's not required by law. There are some industries and there are some positions that are required by law to do background checks, especially those that are working with the vulnerable populations and students. But background checks typically are a matter of company policy and practice, and they're usually done towards the end of the process of interviewing someone versus doing it at the very beginning of the interview and recruiting process.
So by the time the background check comes into play, we already know their names. We would already know their names and their places of employment. Okay.
Correct. Because in order to do a background check, you need to have a release signed. And that release is going to include all of the information, their name, their address, their social security numbers, their dates of birth. So all of that is going to be on a release in order for them to get the background check completed.
Did that answer your questions, Regent McMichael?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Thank you for that question. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you so much for that presentation. I really appreciated the information that was given today. Where do we go from here?
Madam Chair. It's Dale in Reno.
Oh, just who I was thinking of. Go ahead. Acting Chancellor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Dale Arcaga, Acting Chancellor. So in the where do we go from here category, first I want to thank the speaker from SHRM. Very helpful information. I have used blind hiring at another organization. It was a smaller organization. It is not easy to implement. And so I appreciate the context, both for the process of the evaluation of resumes and of the training that is required. So this item is informational today. So next steps would be we'll continue to do research both with the IDEA Council, which is our diversity officers, and with the Human Resources Advisory Council on what implementation looks like, as well as the legal office and some of the questions raised, such as evaluations and uses of search firms. We have a lot more homework to do, but I appreciate the committee putting us on this path, and I appreciate Mr. Williams' diligent research. What I would likely do is come back to the board through this committee with a proposal, either for policy change or more likely a pilot, because this, as the speaker has indicated, this can be a manual process or an automated process. We have to figure out if our automated process, being Workday, can even be revised to do this and what that would cost. And so we may come back with a pilot. But that's our next step, Madam Chair, is to continue at your direction researching in those bodies that I mentioned, with the diversity officer, with the human resources, clearly with the president's, so that we can come back to you with recommendation either for policy change or for a pilot.
Thank you for that. That would be my desire, is to have a pilot before implementation, just have a dry run And it would encourage, I love how Regent Carter mentioned that it would allow more people to, more regents to participate in the process of the selection, as opposed to the way it works now, two people go through the whole, I mean, all the applicants and choose from that. Those two people just rank the applicants, as opposed to having a committee that could, we could possibly have a committee that could rank the applicants, which would give us more eyes on and accomplish that more diverse faculty and staff that we're looking for. And since that, and thank you again, Ms. Clayton. I really appreciate it. And I hope, well, I think we'll be in touch.
Thank you.
And with that, the report from, so item number six, Southern Nevada Diversity Summit information only.
All right. Oh, perfect. Thank you. Would you like to help me with my slides? Okay. This is Seva Yildirim, Vice President for Diversity Initiatives and Chief Diversity Officer at UNLV. I'm here to briefly give you an overview of what a success our 2022 Southern Nevada Diversity Summit was. The 11th of these summits took place on October 7th at UNLV, and we worked in collaboration with the College of Southern Nevada, Desert Research Institute, and Nevada State College. This particular summit was created in 2011 by the NSHE Board of Regents with the leadership of then-Regent Cedric Creer. We were very excited to receive 420 registrants for the summit. Our primary sponsors were MGM Resorts International, Southwest Gas, and the Andre Agassi Foundation for Education, and we had many others who generously contributed to the cost of the summit. We had two keynote speakers. First was Eric Deggans, who's an award-winning journalist, a media analyst, and an author of the well-received book, Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. At lunch, we heard from Ms. Haban Girma, who is the first deafblind person to graduate from Harvard Law School and the author of Haban, the deafblind woman who conquered Harvard Law. Both speeches were phenomenal, and we received really great feedback from all our participants at the summit. We also had three primary panels. First was the president's panel. The second was the elected officials panel, and the third was a panel of our community leaders. In addition to these keynote speakers and primary panels, we had 21 other concurrent sessions, which covered a variety of topics and presentations, including topics on diversifying the healthcare workforce, neurodiversity, and cultivating collaborative communities of care in Southern Nevada. I'm happy to note that we also had several sessions on disability history and empowerment. So I will conclude my brief report by this picture, which I hope sort of relays what a good time was had by all who attended the summit. Thank you all so much for all your continuing support, and I look forward to attending the summit myself, this time as a participant, as it'll be our colleagues at College of Southern Nevada will be hosting it next year. Thank you so much. Yes, I'll stay.
Stay there. Any questions from the committee? I do have a question, actually.
Of course.
What was the most surprising thing about the summit? Like, when you walked into it, what was either unexpected or surprise, but positive?
So this was my first summit. I can tell you this is my seventh higher educational institution as a law professor or an administrator. I think just the enthusiasm of the crowd and, what a large crowd was in attendance, despite, you know, still fears about COVID-19 continuing, I think was, for me, the highlight of the day. There was so much enthusiasm about being in person as well as attending online, and just a sort of camaraderie of those who were in the room, the opportunity to connect with one another from different campuses, with community leaders and community members, I think was certainly the highlight of the day.
Thank you. And what was the actual attendance? Do we have that number?
We don't yet have that number. I'm still waiting on the attendance from the online participants, but I would say we had over 100, I am told, online participants on and off during the day, and over 200 in person, I believe, throughout the day, because some came and left and attended different sessions. But certainly the keynote speaker sessions, both of them, were very well attended, and we've received so far really positive feedback from all those who attended from different colleges.
Thank you. Thank you so much, and thank you for everyone who put it on, and that sounds like it was a big success.
Thank you so much.
Madam Chair? Yes,
go ahead.
I have one question.
Yes.
Were there any indigenous people represented at the summit?
Absolutely. And of course, we started the day with an acknowledgement of the land we were holding the event on. And that was read by one of our indigenous faculty members.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
And if there's no further questions, we'll move on to item number 7, Disability Resource Centers on Inche Campuses. And Yvonne at TMCC is going to lead us off.
I think Tillery has some intro statements.
Yeah, so with this particular agenda item, this is a presentation that it was compiled and put together from each of the institutions, except for DRI. In response to Regent Ariscotta's request at the September board meeting. So with that being said, feel free to go ahead, Yvonne.
Thank you so much. For the record, Yvonne Allen, Truckee Meadows Community College, Executive Director for Student Life. Thank you so much, the IDEA Committee, for giving us this opportunity to highlight our Disability Resource Center. I would like to first acknowledge Tony Fuchsia, Dr. Olga Messina, Bill Probstol, who is with me today, Thomas Kearns, and Gracie Delator. That is our excellent DRC team at TMCC, and they're the ones that are there every day for our students. Slide, please. At TMCC's DRC, our mission statement specifically is student-facing. We wanted to make sure that we are expressing that we are there for our students, for them to become self-sufficient. We also highlight that we are there for them to accomplish their academic and professional goals, whatever they say that may be. Slide, please. Now into the data. So first off, we would like to highlight the number of students that were registered with the DRC. For our data, we used fiscal year 22 so that we would have a whole year of information for you all. For summer 21, we had 101 students registered for the DRC. Fall 21, 393. Spring 22, 322. And this fiscal year is lining up to be very matching numbers as well. When you look at the percentage of students by disability, our top three include psychological, learning disability, and then ADD or ADHD. Slide, please. Next up are the services provided. Our number one, without a doubt, are testing accommodations, followed up by audio recording. And then third would be our e-text and Braille. Slide, please. We specifically wanted to highlight our referral sources. This is a sense of pride for us, that 42% of our referral sources to the Disability Resource Center come from TMCC internal. This means that our TMCC faculty and staff know about the DRC, trust the DRC, and feel very confident in sending our students to our faculty and staff within the DRC. So we're very proud of that, that we have a wonderful reputation and acknowledgement around campus. Slide, please. A few more highlights. TMCC is proud that we have ADA accessible compliant software on all 1,560 academic computers, which covers every TMCC location in Reno, Nevada. This is every academic computer that we have. This software is also available to be installed on all TMCC student personal computers through various programs and license agreements. This software includes NVDA, JAWS, MAGIC, OpenBook, Equato, and Read and Write. Slide, please. And a specific highlight from this semester, we had a student who had a mobility issue, and she was really struggling in her science course. The student's drive to succeed was 100%. We were able to work with our facilities department and use a cart that is normally reserved for them to be able, and our DRC folks, to make sure the student can get to different locations as required in order to meet her course requirements. So this is really a highlight on how our DRC staff goes above and beyond just the accommodations that you saw listed, and they really will think outside the box to make sure our students are getting all needed accommodations. Slide, please. And outside of just within the campus life, we also do community collaboration. TMCC recently hosted 9 Washoe County School District VI and OM teachers for a 3-hour workshop. This workshop was how to prepare students who are blind or have vision loss for college. Among the speakers that presented were the TMCC accommodation specialist, 2 graduate students who are blind from TMCC that moved on to UNR, and the TMCC accessibility specialist. We believe that part of our success at TMCC with our DRC is that we outreach to the school district so that we are preparing the students that will then matriculate to our college. Slide, please. And there is our contact information. Once again, thank you so much for giving us this opportunity to present. Thank you, Regent Arascada, for asking us to highlight our disability resource centers. And myself and Bill are here if there are any questions at the end of all the presentations. Thank you.
Do you want to do questions now? Whatever. Do you have a question, Regent McMichael?
Yes, Madam Chair. My question is, what percentage of the facilities are available for disability accessibility? Are all the buildings accommodating?
Yes. All of our buildings are required to be accessible to students with mobility impairments, visual impairments, etc., under Section 508, I believe. So we do have the architectural standards that we're adhering to. The building's quite old, and our facilities department has gone to great lengths to make sure that we are compliant with that.
TMCC is excited that our DRC is actually separate from our ADA committee. Our ADA committee is a subcommittee of our TMCC Planning Council. This ADA committee has representation from all across campus. It is chaired by a member of our DRC, but includes facilities, equity and inclusion, faculty, and the Faculty Senate as well. So we have a very robust view and a wonderful website even. If you ever notice anything at the TMCC campus that is not accessible or is not functioning as it should be to be accessible, there's a form and it goes directly to our ADA committee.
Thank you.
Ms. Elton, also a question up here in Reno, if I may, Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Regent Arascada.
Thank you much. Ms. Allen, if you can expand on the testing and service accommodations for testing, what type of testing accommodations in particular, and I'm going to ask this of all DRCs, in particular, are you focusing on or are you assisting to make sure there's going to be great student success?
And I'm going to give that question to Bill as our accessibility specialist.
Our primary accommodation for testing is extended time, which we collaborate with our testing services office to arrange. In addition to extended time, we also arrange for basically anything the student needs to attempt a test. Extended time being the most common one, reduced distraction environments, and private testing being the second most common option. And after that, it's really specific to the individual needs of the student.
Possibly a person to assist with writing the answers down.
A scribe can be provided. We also have speech-to-text software available. And again, whatever the student may need, we will make the arrangement.
Wonderful accommodations.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions for TMCC? Before we move on, I was told that lunch is here. So if we're going to do a working lunch, if everybody will not mind, let's take about 10 minutes. Go get your lunches. Come right back. And we're going to hear from WNC next.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Susan Trist, and I'm the Program Director for Disability Support Services at Western Nevada College. Thank you for having us. Next slide, please. So this slide reflects unduplicated headcount for students served in fall of 21, spring of 22, and summer of 22, so the entire year. And you'll see that the largest number there for alternative testing, so in similar to TMCC and probably the remaining institutions, is that alt testing is the primary accommodation that we provide. Next slide, please. This slide reflects other accommodations and services that we provide on a regular basis at TMCC. Excuse me, at WNC. I apologize. I'm nervous. I apologize. All right. Next slide, please. I think that the common theme here on this slide is collaboration. And for our success stories, for years, WNC has collaborated with the Nevada Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities to host a community event to raise disability awareness. Journey of Hope is what that event is called, and it returned in 2022 after a two-year break. WNC, we also sponsor a program called CREST, which is College Readiness for Students in Transition, and it's a program to help transitioning high school students with disabilities successfully transition to college. We offer a three-week introduction to the college experience class that incorporates tools and resources needed to be successful in college. It's a grant-funded program with DETR. A WNC student who is a Paralympic hopeful told his story to a group of WNC staff and students in August of 22. It was an inspirational event and a great way to kick off the academic year. We also, as a system, collaborate. We're all using, as far as I know, most of us are using AIM, which is Accessible Information Management System. It's a database system that helps us gather data. It's also an interface that our students interact with. So it is helpful for our students to be familiar with it, let's say at WNC, and then when they're transferring on to UNR, the system looks the same. So it's definitely helpful to be collaborating with other institutions. Next slide, please. So we included some challenges, and I think I would believe that my colleagues would agree that staying on top of accessibility compliance can be a challenge for all of us. With new instructional and web content coming at us all the time, as well as new staff that are working at our institutions, it's certainly an ongoing issue to make sure we're maintaining compliance. Possibly as a result of COVID, students are arriving at our institution lacking academic skills to succeed at the college level. So resources and time are necessary to address these academic deficits. Next slide, please. Here is the contact information for disability support services at WNC. Does anybody have any questions?
Are there any questions from anyone on the committee or off the committee? Oh, there you go. You answered everybody's questions.
Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation. Next up, College of Southern Nevada.
Make sure we're on. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the Board of Regents. We are very honored here on behalf of our president, Dr. Federico Saragossa. Today, Madam Chair and Regent Arascata, I'm very honored to have with me this afternoon. We have our senior associate with who represents our DRC, Veronica Cantu, who will share some of our numbers that we have here at CSN. Veronica.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Board of Regents, for having us here today. My name is Veronica Cantu, and I am a senior associate, ADAA, specifically from the Henderson campus. I'm very excited to be here with our associate VP, Dr. Felicia Thomas, and she's here. She is our immediate supervisor of the DRC, along with many other departments. Next slide, please. So our students served, you can see that we offer many of the same academic accommodations that were discussed with the previous schools. Similarly, all the data that they're providing, that's following the same trend that we're seeing here at CCSD. I'm sorry, I used to work at CCSD as well, here at CSN. We offer services for students with documented disabilities. We also help the CSN community with hiring students that do not have disabilities to help our students. Next slide, please. As you saw, we have 629 students. This is a breakdown of the class accommodations in this current semester. So our top two are assistive technology, and that encompasses a note-taking software, which we call Glean, which is very popular. A second one is the testing accommodations. You heard a little bit about testing accommodations before. We work specifically with what the disability is to determine what accommodations that the student may need in testing. For example, it's really common for everybody to have time and a half or a maximum of double time. If we had a student with that needed a scribe, we'd have somebody to be there as a scribe helping out with Scantron assistance. If they needed to have a sign language interpreter, we would have those available to them. We also offer readers if somebody needed a reader. We also have adaptive text. So just like it was mentioned earlier, it really depends on what the disability is, how we assist with testing. Next slide, please. So that's just more of our data and breaking down all of the specific accommodations that we give. So you'll see a student with a disability that'll have multiple accommodations. They might have assistive technology, they may have a recording device or note-taking software, they may have a sign language interpreter or a speech-to-text, including tests. So you'll see those numbers really encompass all of the different accommodations, and a student may have many of those. Next slide, please. A few of our success stories. It was actually kind of hard when we all came together as a team and we were saying, okay, what are our biggest success stories? Because we have a lot. We have a very extremely hardworking team. And so these would probably be our top three. The first bullet point talks about Glean. Glean software is a software device that students will take in when they need a recording device for a lecture that's heard one time. So with this device, it's going to go ahead and give that student the opportunity to listen to the lecture multiple times, but it also has a way to turn it from a recording device to a written transcript. So they'll be able to go ahead and not only hear it, but they're going to be able to read it as well. The second bullet point really talks about our staff going above and beyond, which is a tribute or a trait that all of our staff has, from our student assistants to our administrative assistants to our senior associates. We always get a lot of compliments that we made that difference because we went above and beyond. Even before before students get to us as DRC, we are helping students from the get-go. As soon as they self-identify as having a disability, we can help them, whether it's putting an interpreter with a student who's going through orientation. One of the other things that helps us go above and beyond is our collaboration that we have with other departments in CSN. So we have a really good tight network that we can help each other in any step of the way, whether they're with us officially as DRC or until the time they graduate. Our last one is we like to get those handwritten notes. We had one from one of our students that we actually had a student went talk to a one of our administrative assistants yesterday at West Charleston, and the parents literally were in tears. They said, thank you so much. I don't know how I could have done it or helped my student do it without you. So you'll see that theme throughout our office here at CSN. Next slide, please. For contact information, please contact me. You have my telephone number and our address, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions or if you have anything that you would like to say.
Regent McMichael.
Yes, Madam Chair. In addition to being able to read and hear through the software, it is available for printing?
For that note-taking software, Glean, it can provide a written transcript. So all students at CSN can go ahead and print. So say if they don't have their own technology at home, the CSN is a, as a whole can provide that for a student through our computer lab and printing stuff.
And is that free to the student?
It is. Okay. It is. They have a certain amount of pages that they can print, but I've never heard of anybody getting to that max or needing anything more.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Regent Carter.
So this isn't necessarily just for CSN, but I'll ask it to you anyway.
Okay.
So a couple years ago, I asked this question as well. So the high school students that might have like an IEP, when they get to college, I believe they have to just ask for assistance. That IEP kind of disappears from the world. Is there any process to track like the folks that enter with an IEP, or is that it really is up to the student to say, you know, hey, I've always needed this assistance. Can you help me? Or is there a way that we can be proactive in reaching out to those students that have had that assistance in high school?
That's actually a really great question. What we do is the NSHE, DRC, we all work together and we all communicate with our high schools. And so we're working with our transition specialist. I actually did a presentation earlier this year to over 200 transition specialists, I believe, within CCSD. And we start trying to have that conversation and preparing them. We also have YES programs on campus where we'll go ahead and do presentations in those classes. And those are students that are dual enrollment between high school and college. They're taking classes in both. So we do our best to try to reach out. We're also working at Nevada State, where you're going to be talking to Sharnay Walker. They're going to be hosting this January. We're going to have a college night where we're going to be bringing in students and their parents and other transition specialists at the high school, and we're going to be doing individual conversations with them. But as far as those accommodations, just following them, at the high school level, we're working with the schools to make sure that they have the information, because there's a lot of differences between the high school and college. For example, the biggest one is that the student must self-identify. So if a student decides, hey, you know what, I want to do it without DRC, then they can certainly do that. And then another thing is the CCSD, they do a lot of diagnosing for learning disabilities. There's a few different tests, the waist, the weight, that they can take at the high school level that the school CCSD sponsors. But for our psychological impairments, for our mobility impairments, PTSD, a lot of those accommodations that we need for those groups, they have to be diagnosed by a different medical professional. So we'll get some students that come from CCSD, and they provided that information to CCSD for a 504. And when they come to us, yes, they had a 504 or an IEP, but that information that we need has to come from the medical doctor. So whatever they gave to CCSD, we'll say, hey, give that to us. And then we'll, you know, be able to move forward. Now, with all of the colleges, you'll find is it's not automatically, you're not automatically admitted. There are head guidelines that most of us are following. There's 7 different guidelines. And when we review documentations as teams, we'll go through and make sure what those 7 different points are. It's like, what's the diagnosis? When was it originally diagnosed? Is it current? Is it permanent? Is it temporary? What accommodations are they wanting to have, and what is recommended? So it is a step-by-step process. Services are not retroactive, and so we always encourage, let's start that process soon. Did that answer your question?
Yes, that was a lot more thorough than the answer 2 years ago. So
I just gave you DRC 101 for all of us.
Yeah, the big thing is, you know, unless they self-identify, the services don't happen. So like when I was a program chair, people would dig holes because they would graduate from high school and they had these assistant, you know, little things in place to help them. And they would get to college and think, oh, I'm in college now, so I don't need any of this, you know, assistance. So they would start to dig a hole. And so the faster you can find them, the better. So I'm glad that there's some proactivity in reaching to CCSD, and I hope our other institutions are reaching out to their school districts as well.
And also through orientation, right when they come through, orientation is always going to say, contact DRC. Every single professor syllabi says, contact DRC. So at the school, when they get to us too, they're told a lot of different ways. Any other questions?
Okay.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for the presentation.
You're welcome.
Let's see. Next up is Nevada State College, and they are virtual.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for the opportunity to share and highlight DRC's information at Nevada State College. I am Sharnae Walker, and I'm the director of the Disability Resource Center. Next slide, please. We here in the Disability Resource Center are on a mission to do a lot of different things to support our students. First and foremost, we want to make sure that students, all students with disabilities, are afforded the same access and opportunities as their peers. We do this by engaging in a lot of different work. We encourage and promote self-advocacy, ensuring that students have timely and appropriate accommodations. As Veronica mentioned previously, we work with a lot of community partners. I have the pleasure of getting to work with everyone in the room. NG institutions, CCSD, UNLV, Nevada State, CSN, TMCC, everyone, to make sure that all of our students, whether they are transferring between institutions or they are coming from CCSD, they are aware of the process and they are aware of what needs to happen. We do work with CCSD to host the college workshop that happens in January. And then this year we get the pleasure of hosting the college night that will happen in March here on campus, where we will bring our CCSD partners, our parents, our prospective students to talk about the transition process to college, what that means, what the accommodation process is like, so that they have as much information to be prepared for that transition as possible. We also work and partner with our instructors, our campus partners, department, student life, career services to make sure that our students have that connection point to the Disability Resource Center. We also participate in orientation and graduation. I am proud to say that this last graduation, we had 33 DRC graduates. That represents a significant percentage, almost 18% over last year. Many of those graduates were nursing students. I am very proud to say that our partnership with nursing is strong. Nursing recommends and refers students to us all the time, as well as many different campus partners. Next slide, please. academic accommodations are provided similarly as all of the other institutions have spoke about, but it all points back to the documentation. Whatever documentation is provided, whether it's an IEP, a 504 plan, medical history, all of those documents go to support the accommodations that are put in place. And some of the common accommodations are extra time, whether it's time and a half or double time. Software, we also use Glean. We also have on every computer on our NSC campus a program called Read and Write. This program is very similar to Glean, and every student has access to it. It is free of charge. But what you can do with it is upload documents to be able to read them in either, whether it's out loud or in a native language. So if English is not your first language, you can switch languages, whether it's Spanish, whether it is Farsi, any language. There are hundreds of languages that you are able to utilize or switch to. It works, again, very similarly to Glean, where students can take notes. Students can upload digital versions of books and highlight and be able to make notes within that program. And that is accessible to every student on our campus. Every instructor on our campus also has access to it. We do have quiet testing environments. We do provide note-taking assistance if a note-taker, a physical note-taker is needed as opposed to software. During testing, we will also meet the needs of students, whether it is a Scantron assistant or a scribe or a reader. We also have a pretty cool device called a reading pen. So if a student prefers to have a digital device as opposed to a live human, a reading pen is something that they can use as well. And it reads just like a human reader would. But all accommodations are implemented based on the documentation that is provided by the student. Next slide, please. So as you can see, we serve a lot of different students. Our largest category being those who fall into mental health category. So it's psychiatric or psychological. That is where our largest number of students are registered with us, followed by learning disabilities, and again, followed by our students who have PhD. So we have students who are registered in several different categories. Some of them are duplicates because they have, they come with us with comorbid disabilities, comorbid impairment. So they are registered under multiple categories. Next slide. DRC here at NSC provides an annual report to our student affairs, our vice president of student affairs, and we follow the calendar, we follow the fiscal year. So our year starts in the summer, and then we have the fall, and then we have the spring. So this is the data that is reflective of the students that we served and the accommodations that were put in place over our last fiscal year. We are currently in 22-23, and the data is looking very similarly. But our largest category is alternative testing. So that can include extra time to take tests at either 1.5 or 2 times. It can include a calculator. It can include a reader or a scribe, and that testing environment, that distraction reduced testing environment. Next slide, please. Accommodations and classes that we are serving students in almost 600 classes, 597 classes, that represents over 1,800 credit hours. So we are supporting a large number of students in a large number of classes. So we work very diligently to make sure that all of our students are receiving the accommodations in all of their classes. And we have proctored over 650 hours of testing. So we do a lot of testing in our offices. That concludes NSC's information. Does anybody have any questions?
Any questions for Nevada State College? Okay, let's move on to UNR.
Thank you.
UNR is in the Reno office.
I'll do that again. For the record, Dr. Shane Carter, Interim Director, University of Nevada, Reno Disability Resource Center. We've done a lot of work over the last couple of years to build really lasting relationships around campus. And I know that all of our DRCs across the state know what I mean when I say that I'm always very grateful for faculty who work with us to ensure that we are able to accommodate our students and ensure that our institutions remain in compliance. As we do this work, what I've found more and more is the value of just what we do. I'm going to start with the highlight of every single student that we work with, whether they go to completion of their degree or not, is a success story. Not necessarily just because they're in college, but the amount of work, dedication, and just time of their lives that they spend to be successful in school is absolutely amazing. Next slide, please. This is just an array of the different accommodations that everybody else has listed. I was hoping that you were all going to get the written report for today, which listed all of our stuff, but I can absolutely send that to anybody who needs it. Our biggest accommodation that we provide, like everyone else, is alternative testing. We are lucky enough to have our own testing facility in our office. We have 25 rooms with 58 seats. Each one of the rooms has sound dampening panels with it or adjustable chair or adjustable desks so that students can have the mobility needs that they need when they're taking exams. We started our university with 1.25 extension on testing time, and that's always based on documentation. So that's our standard of where we start. We usually don't do anything above double time, and that, again, that's dependent on documentation. We provide scribes if students need them. We just went as an institution to a lockdown browser for exams through Canvas. It uses Respondus. Because of that software, we quickly found out that students were not able to utilize their text-to-speech software. So we quickly worked with our Office of Digital Learning and got an institutional license for Kurzweil, because on campus, on all of our computers, we have ClaroRead, which is not the same. And that Respondus software only talked to Kurzweil. Additionally, in all of our labs across campus, we have JAWS software now, which is absolutely amazing to put an institutional license so that any of our blind students can go anywhere across campus. They don't need to go to specific labs to do that. We do provide our students with Glean. Well, we've done so for a while. We also have the benefit here in Reno of the Digital Wolfpack Initiative, which provides all of our freshmen and now freshmen and transfer students their own iPad. Well, with that comes technology that the institution pushes out that students are able to use. What we were able to do at the DRC was advocate for our DRC students, actually all students across campus get it, the ability to use Notability, which is an OIS software that only works with Apple products. So a lot of our students love using that. It's replaced our LiveScribe pens, which we provided for years. So now students get an iPad, get the Apple Pencil. They can audio record while they're writing. When they go back to study, they touch on their notes and it replays it from that exact moment in time. And they like it because they can write on their PowerPoints directly. So it's been amazing to see that transition. Currently, we're serving about 16% of our total student body, and that includes undergraduate, graduate, and medical students. We're seeing a 2-to-1 ratio of females versus males who are registering with us. We've seen a huge increase in mental health, like all of our other DRCs have, especially since the pandemic occurred. And I think there's also a realization that the reduction of stigma for mental health in society has also led to us having this influx of students registering. For the first time ever, we're having students at 18 who are on medication, who have been seeing a therapist in their local community, who are now matriculating to us. And that usually wasn't the case prior to coming to college. We do know that the onset age for a lot of different diagnoses is 18 to 24. So that's also probably to be expected, I would assume. The largest group that we serve is psychological disabilities, followed by ADHD, followed by learning disabilities. It's pretty consistent with everybody else's percentage of numbers. We have 114 veterans, 89 student athletes, and we've had 74 DETA referrals in the last year. So we're happy to work with all of those different organizations to collaborate across the board to be able to do that. Questions?
Any questions? Well, thank you for that presentation. Next up is, go ahead. Thank you so much. UNLV Disability Resource Center.
Hello, my name is Brian Hilbert, and for the last 7 years, I've had the pleasure. Did you get that for the record? My name is Brian Hilbert, and for the last 7 years, I've had the pleasure to serve as the director of the Disability Resource Center at UNLV. And so much of what I could tell you would be similar to the wonderful things you've heard from my colleagues around the state. But for us, we see new students every week of the semester letting us know that they need assistance. So this slide, we actually serve now over 2,700 students with documented disabilities ranging from first year to graduate and medical students. And my staff does this by facilitating academic accommodations, by providing case management services and coordinating across campus to make sure that students get what they need. Of course, lots of test proctoring. I think one of the things I'm most thankful for is that I've had the help and support of our senior leadership to not only meet current needs, but to plan for future needs. So in 2018, we sat down and knew that we were going to need more space. We were going to need more seats for accommodated testing. So since 2015, we went from 6 seats in our accommodated testing center to 16 seats in an accommodated testing center. And today, we have a center that's being put together that's 60 seats for accommodated testing. We provide faculty and staff training, and our goal is always to hit 100% of academic departments with training. We hit about 90% each year, and it's really a bystander model. So it's teaching them about disability, but it's also teaching them about how do you help a struggling student, and you help them by referring them to a basket of resources, whether it's my office or our wonderful counseling center or other student supports. And the reason that we've grown from 750 students when I came in 2015 to 2,700 students are those great folks that are out there working every day with students and letting them know that UNLV is a supportive place, and I'm glad to be able to play a role in that. We've also developed a unique and special follow-along program. So my staff, when they identify a student who might need some extra assistance, they will schedule meetings with them and make sure that they're connecting with the supports that exist and are interacting with the institution as a whole as they should. And that's been great. So those are the students that we're identifying, and that's how we're working with that special population. We also support our students who are pregnant or experience temporary injuries. So, you know, getting hurt on spring break or fall break and you break something isn't a disability, but you still need support to be able to continue your education and go on to graduation. So when you think about our numbers, we currently serve over 8.6% of the entire UNLV student population. We work with that 127 at-risk students that I mentioned, and we give them organizational skills review, time management strategies, referrals to other campus offices, and work with our Academic Success Center to beef up their study skills. And our philosophy, it starts with self-determination and self-advocacy. When you come to college, you're getting an education, but you are leading in your future. And that's very different from the K-12 experience. So that's one of the things that we try to reinforce in every communication and every meeting. We have also built a special pilot program with our School of Medicine to support their students specifically, and we've started to break out some of these specialized complex programs and work with those academic staff to make sure that we have high-level academics, but also high-level support. We've built a partnership with our Student Veterans Center and support almost 200 student veterans who have a disability, injury, or some service-connected issue. I'm very happy that we, when we relocated to our new space that has that 60-seat testing center, over the next year, we will be co-located with several academic support offices, and our hope is that people see the DRC as part of that academic support, not any kind of stigma or anything that would have existed in the past. And I'll conclude my remarks by telling one of our success stories. I think it's unfair because we have so many each semester, but I'd like to tell you about Ben Jansen. So Ben was a student who came here starting with vocational rehabilitation. He was a flight attendant on a weekend with his friends, broke his neck, woke up in the hospital, and had to transition to a nursing facility for several years. He was able to get some funding, move into the community, and start his education. But unfortunately, like so many people find themselves, he ran out of money. Well, our foundation found an organization, the Nielsen Foundation, that supported students with spinal cord injuries, and we worked together to apply to become a Nielsen school, very elite, less than 20 in the nation. They accepted us, and we were able to provide scholarship support to Ben and to several other students. Today, not only did he finish his degree at UNLV, but he's back at the Boyd School of Law, learning to be an attorney, to be a disability rights advocate for others. Do you have any questions?
Any questions from the board or any member? Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And next, GBC.
Hi, good afternoon. For the record, I am Arista Sweat. I am the Student Disability Services Coordinator for Great Basin College. All right, next slide. GBC currently serves 126 students. Just like the other institutions, alternative testing is our number one accommodation provided. Please do not mistake the number of students eligible for how time intensive that is, though. So we offer alternative testing, audio recordings of lectures, accessible course materials, note-taking assistance, and reduced course loads. While note-taking assistance has only 14 students that are eligible, that requires quite a bit of time. And also captioning is not on this list. We have 4 students eligible for captioning, and that's also pretty time intensive. So, but we do mirror other institutions as far as eligibility for accommodations. Next slide. Regarding services provided, again, very similar to the other institutions. We have classroom accommodations, assistance with note-taking, testing accommodations such as extended time, scribes, we have people who read exams, and we also offer a separate setting. We offer a sign language interpreter, accessible text, which is essentially if you can't read a standard textbook, then you are able to like get an alternative format that might potentially let you read aloud or depending on your need. We just want to make that accessible. And assistive technology, again, screen readers, any technology you use that makes it accessible. All right, next slide. We'll continue on with some recent stories of success here at GBC. So next slide. Like Nevada State College, we got on board with Read and Write. That happened last year, and I was very excited about that. That, just to echo what they said, this software assists not only DRC students, but all GBC students and staff. As long as you have a GBC email account, you can have websites and documents read aloud for you. Again, very excited about the language translation. It'll help you with reading pictures. So a great piece of software that we did not have until last year. Another highlight we had was collaboration with other NG institutions. I just returned to campus from a three-month maternity leave on Tuesday, and UNR stepped in and they helped us out because our DRC at GBC is an office of one, so I am the DRC, and they did a great job and really appreciate that, and they're not the only institution I've reached out to that has helped. We we all have a common purpose and we all have a common mission, and everyone wants to help our students. And so I'm reaching out to TMCC. I've reached out to Western in the last 6 months. Don't worry, other institutions, I'll be reaching out to you as well. I'm not the origin of all good ideas, so the more we can get to help our students, the better. I do. It's not on the slide here. I do want to mention that we have been doing some high school outreach as well. We've reached out to special education departments throughout the state. Currently, we've got an in-person meeting planned at Elko High School, and we're going to be talking to the students and the parents right there with them to answer their questions and to guide them through the process. Because like the other institutions have mentioned, there's a lot of confusion as far as transitioning from college to high school, and they think that IEP automatically transfers, and it doesn't. And we don't want students to get caught in the middle of the semester thinking, oh, I thought that automatically shifted over. So I'm really excited. We'll see how that goes and kind of expand on that program as we go. And as far as the collaboration as well, going back to that, we recently got on board with AIM, and when I arrived at GBC in 2020, we were very paper-based. And tracking information like intakes and also like looking at our trends, because to best serve our students, we need those data. We need that data. We need to see those trends. And that was very difficult with a paper-based system. So we adopted AIM this fall, and I've already been looking at some of the numbers since I got back. And I'm very excited about what we can do with that, because we want to focus our efforts. We want to have impact. All right, next slide. And again, a lot of the challenges, I'm going to echo mostly what the other DRC said. Web document compliance is always a challenge. And we were looking at software recently that would check all of our courses in Canvas for document compliance. But the one thing with the challenge is it's staffing or money. And the software we were looking at was anywhere from $13,000 to $22,000, which for a bigger institution might not be such a big deal, but for GBC, that's quite a bit of money. So we've been doing faculty trainings, but this can get pretty overwhelming for faculty as well. ADA a lot of times is commonly misunderstood. So that's a challenge. Captioning compliance, again, we're going back to people and money. A captioning for 1 hour, when we were looking at prices, is about $72 an hour. So if you're looking at 1 3-credit course for one student for one semester, it runs above $3,000. So if you times that by 4, we're looking at $12,000 for one student. But they absolutely need that, and that's something that we need to make sure they have. So to save money, sometimes I've done the captioning. That takes about 8 hours for 1 hour of lecture. So I'm going to be honest, it's not a sustainable pace, so outsourcing will be involved, but it's a challenge for us. Third-party software accessibility, also echoing what Shane Carter from UNR said. Issues with some of our securities, like Respondus Lockdown Browser, we've run into those issues. And there have been other things that have kind of popped up as we've gone along, but again, always a challenge. Note-taking compliance, trying to find peer note-takers. Always trying to find reliable peer note takers who are willing to volunteer is again something that we struggle with, because we're largely an online institution. And when I talk to faculty members, I'm like, hey, we need to locate a peer note taker. They say, I don't see who's taking notes in my class, and I don't know what type of notes they take. They may be reliable with their assignments, but we're not seeing, you know, what they're putting down on paper. So that's a challenge for our faculty members. And that's also a challenge for, you know, my office as well. And we've also got some campus buildings, our Meriden Family Housing, that there's no way to make it wheelchair accessible. It was built before some of the current codes were in place. And we looked into it, and the cost is just something that we can't swing right now. But we don't currently have any students requiring the use of a wheelchair that need to be in there. But that's something that's just, it's on our radar. And we don't currently have housing that is compatible with families that is wheelchair accessible. And also ADA push buttons, if you are using a wheelchair, you want to have that. You don't want to have to wait for somebody to open the door for you. And every once in a while, they'll go out, and I'm kind of relying. I do my walking tours on Friday, and I'm hitting buttons, but you have to rely on people to report that as well. And
The one thing that, when we talk about the, I just want to end with this. When we're talking about compliance issues and we're talking about challenges, yes, we're talking about federal mandates, but the reason behind the federal mandates is a person with a need. And, you know, when I'm looking at compliance and I'm looking at trying to, you know, make this campus accessible, I'm thinking about people. Like, we have a student that he has a motorized wheelchair and he drives across town to get to campus. And it's 17 degrees outside, like today at 9 a.m. in Elko, Nevada, and he's driving across. He shouldn't have to get to GBC and wait for somebody to fix the button, or he should find this campus thoughtful and truly accessible to him. And when we're thinking about compliance with like screen readers and web compliance, you know, I'm thinking about the 18-year-old student that confided in me that he's like, I'm supporting my disabled parent and I'm financially supporting them as well. So he's got enough on his plate. He doesn't need to log in and suddenly face a barrier with not being able to see what's on his screen. So again, when I'm thinking about these mandates, I'm thinking about the people behind, the reasons for these mandates. And also, you know, when I'm talking to faculty, I like to say, hey, if you don't experience a disability that would fall under the ADA, you're not disabled, you're temporarily abled. So if we live a life long enough, hopefully, we will still experience a need that falls under the ADA. So again, we're all temporarily disabled. When we're doing this for students, we're also doing it for our future selves. So I just wanted to put that out there. We take this very seriously. And I just want to thank you for your time, and thank you for making a special meeting just for this. Does anyone have any questions?
I don't see any questions. Are there any questions? Thank you so much. Oh, wait. We have a question?
Not really a question.
Yeah. Okay. Regent Carvalho.
Excuse me. Thank you, Chair Perkins. Thank you for bringing this forward. Regent Ariscott, I appreciate your efforts in bringing this forward as well. The people that we've heard from today at each of the institutions, I commend you all for what you do. I know that you have a passion for this work, and I see it when I see you speak. And so I really do appreciate what you do for our institutions and really our students and the future of Nevada. So thank you for that. And just thinking about it, I was a note taker when I was a student at CSN. And it was a great experience for me. I got to know the person that I was taking notes for, and we became really good friends. So if there are any students watching and are interested in doing this, I think it's definitely something that you should consider to help out your fellow students. I was wondering when you were speaking about the collaboration with the different institutions, is there any effort in collaborating on licenses for these assistive programs and things like this? Are you able to, especially with our smaller institutions who may find that the price of these licenses are extensive, do you work with the larger institutions, or is that okay to ask for some feedback on that?
That was my question, actually.
Great.
Good.
Thank
job.
You.
I can speak to our recent exploration with AIM. We asked about that as far as like maybe a statewide thing or with NG institutions, and we were told that would not be a possibility. So I can't speak to every assistive technology out there, but that is that's what I was told on the most recent one. Mm-hmm.
Brian Hilbert for the record, and I am the, in addition to being the director of the DRC at UNIV, I'm the incoming president of our State Association of Disability Service Providers. And we have had those discussions, but as my colleague pointed out, right, the people who run those companies are astute business people. And so you really have to either get together in a significant way and speak with one voice, or you've got to bring something to the table that a cost discount makes sense for them. And I think that's something that we had some conversations about back in 2017 and 2018. And then the pandemic happened, of course. So, but I do think it's something that we can look at long term. And of course, I would love to help anybody in the system that's student focused and doing their part to help students.
Thank you for that. Any further questions? Awesome. Thank you. Any questions from anybody on or off the board? Or on or off this committee, I'm sorry. Thank you, everyone, for those presentations. I really appreciate it. I was thinking of probably making this a yearly thing that every year comes back to this committee with those with this type of information. It's really important that we stay on board and stay ahead of it and stay enthusiastic about it. With that, we'll move to number 8, new business. Is there any new business? Go ahead, Regent
New
McMichael.
Business?
I saw Regent McMichael, and then we'll go to Regent Arascata.
Thank you, Chair. I wanted to find out, do we have any metrics available for how credit history affects students when they finance for higher education? Because that's probably more important than how much they actually have to spend for that higher education is how long your credit history taking such a dramatic drop will affect them over the next 10, 20, or even 30 years, depending on how long they have to repay. That affects how they get a house, lower interest on credit cards, purchase an automobile. That probably is more important than the actual amount that they have to pay for higher education. So I would like to find out, are we teaching students and parents what it means when they take out a loan and their credit rating prevents them from either purchasing something with a reasonable credit or not? Thank you.
Thank you. Regent Arascata?
Chair Perkins, you actually stole my thunder. I was going to request that the presentations that were provided today are done on an annual basis.
Great minds think alike. Thank you, sir. And following along with what Vice Chair Carvalho said, maybe there's something that we can do at the entry level to share those licenses or make some type of offer from this committee. And with that, close new business. Oh, Regent Carter.
Not on the committee, but I think it'd be interesting to see a building accessibility report. You know, if there are buildings on, especially the smaller campuses or remote campuses that probably met ADA back in the day, but maybe don't meet it now, it might be kind of interesting to know where we are.
Thank you. Any other?
Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
Madam Chairman, if I can follow up on Regent Carter's request. There is the University of Nevada, Reno does do a bi-monthly ADA plan review. They have an ADA plan review committee in which they, of course, their campuses, the oldest of campuses, but they do a review of all campus accessibility specifically for physical, from making sure that you can access the campus, park on campus, get from parking lot to class, class under a desk to all campus activities, back to car and out. So per that recommendation or per that request from Regent Carter, yes, that is something that's taking place. And I can only echo, I would love to see that on all campuses as they continue to age.
Thank you. Thank you for that information. And that takes care of new business. We are now up to public comment. Any public comment in ELCO?
No public comment in ELCO.
Thank you. Public comment in Reno?
None in Reno.
Thank you. Public. I don't see any. The room is clear in Las Vegas. And any public comment virtually? Thank you so much, everyone. And that concludes our meeting.